My name is John Bosnich. I'm a Canadian journalist and a former government advisor in Canada and in Japan and also here in Serbia. I was a very active student leader in Canada. I was elected to four terms as the student union president of a university student union in Eastern Canada. And that was probably my first awakening to how corrupt our system was. I had been active in high school, but in university it became a matter of money and concessions on the campus. I ended up getting expelled from the university, taking the university to the Supreme Court of our province. It was a roughly $2.5 million legal battle, which ended up with a draw. I managed to extort my degree from them. And then I went from Eastern Canada up to Montreal, where I had planned to sort of calm down and do a master's degree in political history. However, I was only there 3 months until I ran into a police brutality case on the street. It ran into me. I was walking down the street and the police assaulted a completely innocent bystander. I intervened to protect him. It looked like they were going to kill him. This was in 1987, and to make a very long story short, I ended up testifying as the star witness of the Crown prosecution of the police, which ended up in the first ever conviction and ordering to prison of police for brutality in the 450-year history of Montreal. As a result, the Crown prosecutor was contacted by the police union and by the police lawyer and told that they couldn't guarantee Bosnich's my safety. And I said, okay, no problem. I'll leave Montreal and I'll go to New York. They said, no, we can't guarantee your safety in North America. And so I ended up leaving for Asia on the advice of the Crown prosecutor, who said, if you like staying alive, you should make a long time trip for at least 6 months to Asia. I went to Asia, made my way up through Southeast Asia to Japan. And in Japan, I was hired there to work for the national broadcaster, NHK. It's Japan's world service in English. And I also worked for the Yomiuri Shimbun, which at that time was the largest circulation newspaper in the world. I also worked for the American Chamber of Commerce magazine, and the Nikkei, which is Asia's version of the Wall Street Journal, as well as being a speechwriter for various government agencies and for leading companies. In the end, I managed to become an advisor to the Prime Minister's office, and I was working on and succeeded in opening a pipeline project, which was just completed this past year, linking Siberian gas to Japan and to the rest of the Far East. That put me on the very unfriendly list with the United States deep state. And actually compound the problems, while I was working for the Prime Minister's office, world chess champion Bobby Fischer came to Japan and got arrested at Tokyo's Narita Airport for playing chess in Serbia 12 years earlier during the sanctions against Serbia. So I resigned as the Prime Minister's office advisor. I volunteered to defend Bobby Fischer in the court there, even though I'm not a lawyer. I forced the Japanese government to recognize me as his counsel. And then I fought a 9.5 month legal battle, much like Julian Assange's battle now, to free Bobby Fischer. I sued the Japanese government and we won a battle in their courts. And then I sued George Bush in a grand jury case in Washington. And we succeeded in that battle and we got Bobby Fischer out and got him asylum in Iceland. Of course, that basically ended my ability to work as an advisor or a company a company advisor or communications consultant in Japan. And I decided to leave Japan. I left Japan, moved to Washington, where I became a non-governmental organization spokesman for ethnic Serbs in the United States and Canada, as well as actively lobbying and fighting against the U.S. aggression in the Balkans. I did that until the United States recognized the pseudo-mafia state of independent Kosovo, so-called. And when they did that, there was no point in staying any further in the United States. So I moved with my family to Serbia, where I've continued since 2008 to be actively involved in alternative media. And during that time, when I did arrive here, I had moved here after previously working to defend Slobodan Milosevic when he was the first target of the series of color revolutions around the world. So I defended Milosevic. I also worked to help his defense in The Hague, where, unfortunately, I believe he was murdered. And in the meantime, I also was active in defending Saif Gaddafi and also spoke out about the activities in Syria and elsewhere around the region. Of course, the wars in Croatia, Bosnia, I was on the front lines as a war reporter throughout the entire period of the civil wars in the former Yugoslavia. That's a basic summary.
It is a pretty good one. Now, I think we just start by asking about, if you don't mind, about Milosevic and Gaddafi, about the right and some wrongs of those cases. And can you just explain what happened? Why were those both of those two, such controversial figures? And particularly, clearly, the first one, Milosevic, why do you think he was murdered?
Well, I met and got to know Milosevic personally while I was here. When I first came here as a reporter for Japanese radio television, they sent me from Tokyo. I started to report on a lot of the news that simply wasn't being covered in the West. There was not one word of anything that was not along the demonization of the Serbs mainstream party line. You literally couldn't get anything published. So I volunteered to work for the National News Agency here in Serbia. At that time, it was the former Yugoslavia, and it was the Tanjug News Agency, which at one time was one of the world's leading news agencies. I came there, they had no budget, they had no equipment. So we digitized them and gave them the ability to present photos and video over the net. And I also worked for Radio Television Serbia, and I missed being in the studio when the United States conducted its war crime bombing and killed 16 of my colleagues at RTS headquarters here in Belgrade. I missed it by 45 minutes. And that's just, I was late showing up. I had a news report that I had to file, and that's luckily how I'm alive today. During the course of the NATO a war of aggression against the former Yugoslavia, which was intended to rip the country apart and literally cannibalize it, give some colonies to Germany, some colonies to America, and some zones of interest to other NATO partners. I realized that this was a pre-planned destruction of a target country. It was not an internal breakdown of the former Yugoslavia. And I know that because I traveled through all of the regions of the former Yugoslavia and I spoke to all sides in the conflict. And there was clearly not the basis for an animosity-driven war of hatred between the peoples, but instead a manipulation of the people on the ground by forces mainly from outside of the country. And that was very simple to do because they had unlimited money, they had NATO firepower behind them, and they had their own version of deep state sleeper agents inside the country ready to be activated whenever NATO told them to do so. So that was another eye-opening experience. So I did that. I went back to Japan after that war and thinking that, oh, well, maybe this was an isolated area of disorder or instability. I came back to Japan and I saw the same thing in Japan. And I realized that Japan itself, a rich G7 world power, is nothing more than an American colony. I worked in the Prime Minister's office. We saw direct orders coming down from Washington to the Prime Minister of Japan. I actually had a confrontation in the office of the Prime Minister when the order came down from Washington for the Prime Minister of Japan to arrest Bobby Fischer and turn him over to America for having the audacity to play chess in Serbia despite the U.S. crippling sanctions against the country. And the order just came down as if it was an order to a busboy in a restaurant. And I raised the issue publicly and I said, is the Prime Minister of Japan nothing more than the a state governor in America? And the answer effectively was, no, they aren't even at the level of a state governor. So this is the way the world is run. And once you realize that that's the way it's run in Japan, then I traveled to Korea, I traveled to Thailand, I traveled around the region and realized that this is the way the entire empire is run. I went back to Canada.
Well, yes,
and
John,
realized
I would say something similar probably has just happened with Afghanistan and London. You know, London getting the orders, right, we're leaving Afghanistan. And it's, yep, there is really no choice but by the British military or the British Prime Minister as to whether to leave or not.
Right. London is it's a special colony of the United States. London is let's put it this way. London is much like the Greeks were after the Romans took over the former Greek city-states and the Greek imperial territory. They hired the Greeks. They didn't actually hire them. They enslaved them. And they made the Greeks teach the barbaric Romans. The Romans had much less education, so they would enslave philosophers and educators and what we would call professors today, bring them to Rome and get them to in some way minimally civilize the Romans, who were actually a brute force empire. And this is a parallel today with England, where you have brute force empire being the United States, where it can put millions of men in the field. And its presidents are routinely selected by secret groups, by the Bilderbergers, like Freemasonry, and are selected at a young age in their early 20s and sent on Rhodes scholarships to England to be trained by the enslaved and taken to America, with the exception of John Oliver, who is at the forefront of the new propaganda, which is just comedy. Since people don't have the time to learn anything about politics, the only way you can propagandize them is getting them propagandized through Saturday Night Live, through John Oliver, and through various comedians who make you laugh at your enemies. But not to digress too far, the fact is that people like Bill Clinton, who grew up in a trailer park, are taken over to Oxford, educated, turned into servants of the empire, and then re-injected back into the United States, where they take a cheeseburger and some fries and pretend to be just like any other local yokel, and they get themselves elected there. And it's not that hard to get elected.
That's right. I mean, we have a similar situation with our mayor, Marvin Rees in Bristol, who was actually tapped up at a very young age in his early 20s and sent over to Yale to become a Yale World Fellow, and then returned to us in Bristol as a sort of clone, really, of the I suppose what you could really only describe as an operator for the mafia state. So he will then make sure that all of the financial interests in Bristol get their way and the people are just ridden roughshod over. So it does, I think, work both ways. But look, I'm going to drag you back to talk a bit about Milosevic, because he's an interesting character. Can you just tell us who he was and what is it that makes you think that he was killed rather than just died whilst he was on trial in The Hague?
Come on. You know, I was very closely involved in defending him and bringing witnesses to the Hague. I met Milosevic in the in the middle 90s when I came here in 1994 and volunteered to reorganize Tanyug News Agency. Something I think I should mention, I'm not of a leftist background. I'm not a communist. I'm not even I couldn't say I could even call myself a socialist. So it was I come from a family that was exiled from the former Yugoslavia. My father was a royal officer. My grandfather was the commander of the Royal Guard and a distant cousin of the king. So I was not naturally on Milosevic's side because of any political proclivities. To the contrary, most of the friends and acquaintances of our family were shocked when I volunteered to come here to work in defense of Serbia from foreign aggression in cooperation with the same communists who exiled my family for 60 years. And the reason I'm saying that is not because I'm crazy, but because it was a question of principle. The sovereignty of the country was being threatened by a foreign warmonger empire. To me, it did not matter who the president was or which political party he came from. Milosevic naturally came out of the Titoist Communist Party of the former Yugoslavia. And I can tell you, he was actually surprised to hear that I was not just interested, but actively engaged in defending him and defending the country against foreign aggression. So toward the end of Milosevic's time in power, and I don't call it rule, Milosevic was regularly democratically elected in routine normal elections here in Serbia under a proportional electoral system. Now, a proportional electoral system is very hard to rig. You have a proportion of votes taken at the election, and you get that proportion of seats in the parliament. So during the time of Milosevic's period in office in this country, he was almost always in a coalition government with other parties. And that's something you'll never hear in the Western media. They call him Serbian dictator Slobodan Milosevic, strong man, war leader, blah, blah, blah. Complete, total lies from start to finish. And this really was the awakening experience that followed in the track of the things I had seen as a student union leader. It followed in the track of the things I had seen in putting the police, getting the police sent to jail. It followed in the track of the things that I had seen in the way our system works in the West. And here I saw myself in the former Yugoslavia. And my name is Bosnich. So I'm not far from the old homeland. My father left here, and I had an interest in coming back here to seek my own identity and my own roots, and I found them. I came here to to Belgrade and was immediately, even though I didn't speak Serbian when I arrived, I started to learn the language. And as soon as I expressed my views here, after a lifetime of being called a radical in the West, I was accepted with open arms, and people just said, that's eminently logical. We understand exactly what you're saying. Because there's not, despite the fact that it was a former communist dictatorship, there's a tendency here among the people, which are largely a peasant nation, which was agriculturally oriented until the 1960s, to just say things as you see them. And when you do that, and when you have other people do that back to you, you start to communicate on a level that you rarely ever reach in the Western world, where it's more a system of politesse and saying what's not objectionable. Please don't cause a controversy. Please don't be radical. Please don't shake things up here. Please don't rock the boat. Those are the mantras of life in Canada, America, and I would dare say in England too.
No, you're probably right, I think. But anyway, well, Milosevic, what yes. What makes you think that he was actually murdered rather than died whilst on trial?
Let's go back first. I through my contact with Milosevic personally, and through my access to government records, through media reports, through videos, through transcripts of his speeches. And I'll mention something for your readers. There's a very useful website out there called the Emperor's New Clothes .net. T-E-N-C. The Emperor's New Clothes .net. If you want to find out what Milosevic really stood for and what he really said when the BBC and other lying mainstream media completely mistranslated his speeches, completely said the exact opposite, go to TENC, T-E-N-C, .net and read what Milosevic really said in his speech on the Field of the Blackbirds. That's the Kosovo battle, the 600th anniversary of Serbia's defeat by the Ottoman Empire was marked here in Serbia. And I remember watching the BBC coverage, which was exactly opposite of what Milosevic really said in his speech. And it's easy to do that. You can, if you're the lying mainstream media and you've got an audience of tens or hundreds of millions of people, of whom no one speaks Serbian, you can put a few clips of video up and you can then say whatever you like to say he said. And they did that. It was the exact opposite. He spoke of brotherhood and unity, of not having a civil war, of not being a nationalist state, and he was portrayed as the exact opposite. And I can tell you that I think that NATO and the Western military-industrial complex have actually outdone Adolf Hitler and Joseph Goebbels in demonizing the Serbs, compared to what Hitler and Goebbels did in form of demonizing the Jews. I think that the modern day demonization of the Serbs was more effective, more believed, because you can say that the demonization of the Jews may have been believed inside Germany, but it was not believed universally around the planet. But the demonization of the Serbs was universally, with very few exceptions, believed around the planet. So people would say to me, for example, oh, why are you defending a communist dictator when your own family was exiled by his party? And I would say, well, I've met the man and I've interviewed him at length and I've reviewed all of his speeches, and he is not, was not, and could not have been a communist dictator under the Constitution of Serbia. And I personally monitored elections and spoke to thousands of people during my years in the region. And their answer was, why are you covering up for him? This means that the level of propagandization of the public in the West was so deep and so effective that people who had known me through my years of political activity in Canada, and who knew me not to lie, and who knew me to stand up for principles and for human rights up to the Supreme Court level, up to the level of putting the first police to go to prison in the history of Montreal, 450 years, those people would believe that, but they would not be able to believe one word of what I reported with direct evidence, with direct video and direct audio files about the Serbs. And so hats off to the New World Order, because they are better at lying and better at demonizing than even Adolf Hitler.
So Milosevic, he died, didn't he, whilst he was on trial?
So what happened to him in trial? So Milosevic was, of course, he was betrayed. The agents working for NATO and the military-industrial complex of the Western states paid off the chief of police and the chief general of the military. I met Milosevic about 6 weeks before the final election, which was stolen. It was not fairly won by his opponent, who was selected. His opposing candidate was selected by Madeleine Albright from the United States. She just walked in and said there were a group of competing what I would call janissaries. Janissary is a word used to describe children who were abducted by the Ottoman Empire from Christian states that they had occupied, taken away to Istanbul, turned into Muslim warriors, and sent back through the rule of primogeniture of first sons to rule the villages from which they had come and convert them into Muslims. So these people who were propagandized by the Ottoman Empire, I just want to go back to what you mentioned earlier about the scholarships of people from America and from England going to America. Cecil Rhodes, who created a country after his own name, a racist robber colony called Rhodesia. Cecil Rhodes used his immense wealth from stealing the diamonds and gold of South Africa to create a scholarship, which is now among the most sought after scholarships in the Western world, a Rhodes Scholarship. I was to be nominated for that scholarship, and I went home excited to tell my father, who was a political science professor, "Hey, Dad, I've been suggested by my professors to be nominated for a Rhodes Scholarship, and they're almost 100% certain that I'll get it." And he said, "Well, good for you, John. If you do accept a Rhodes Scholarship, please never speak to me again." And of course, I asked my father, "Well, why is that?" He said, "Because that is the training ground for the Janissaries of the new oppressor empire." And so this ties into the way people are trained. They create, the English have the Rhodes Scholar. I never talk about the UK or Great Britain. Its ruling class is the English. And the English are the Angles, a German tribe that occupied Great Britain and put itself in power and said, "Hier ist Angelland," England, for some people who don't know where their own country's name comes from. They created this training system called the Rhodes Scholarship. The Americans, when they inherited the British Empire after World War II, created their own parallel called the Fulbright Scholarships. And the worst enemies of the people that you'll ever find are people who've got both a Fulbright and a Rhodes Scholarship, like Vuk Jeremic, a Serb who served as the chairman of the General Assembly of the United Nations, on the call of both America and England. So back to Milosevic. Milosevic was eliminated because he refused to play ball with the empire. He had an opportunity, like many former communists in the Eastern Bloc. Serbia and Yugoslavia were not totally inside the bloc. They played a middle road. But he had the opportunity to convert, become an American agent. And for one reason or another, the ethnic discrimination against Serbs in Kosovo by militant, extremist terrorists trained by the CIA caused him such revulsion that he simply cut off all of his westernizing efforts to become, let's say, integrated with the West without having to have the fall of the former socialist system. So he then became targeted. He was targeted like Ceausescu, and Ceausescu was still a dictator. He was not elected. He was still a party apparatchik. But Milosevic built alliances with all manner of political parties from the left to the right to defend his country against foreign aggressors. That is a big difference. And he was the only such figure in Eastern Europe. Milosevic continued to trust the people. And even though the American Senate spent $72 million U.S. dollars to skew the elections in his final election for president, Milosevic continued to contest the elections and fought bravely on. The elections were stolen. He was then removed from power, and he was placed under house arrest. And then the American agents here literally stormed the house in which he was held in house arrest. He was taken to the main prison in downtown Belgrade. And before he was taken there, before the election was held, I met with him and I advised him not to hold the election because the election was totally rigged by the external forces. He said, "I can't believe it. I don't believe it." And beside him were General Pavkovich and General Georgievich. General Pavković was the chief of staff of the Yugoslav army, and General Georgevic was the chief of staff of the police of Yugoslavia. And both of them laughed when I said, if you go to election now, they will steal the election. They will stage a fake revolution, paying 100,000 people to come in front of the parliament to remove you. And it wasn't me inventing these things from thin air. I had actual sources who were telling me how much they were being paid to show up to contest the election legitimacy. I knew how much they were paid, who was busing them, when they were coming, and where they were going. And I told this to President Milosevic face to face, and I said, here, Mr. President, is my phone number. If things go as you don't think they're going to go, the way I tell you they're going to go, these two generals on either side of here, Pavković and Georgevic, are going to be nowhere to be seen. And they both got very upset. I said, I'm speaking to the president, not to the two of you. But I'm pointing at the two of you so he remembers what I say. Neither you, Mr. Police General, nor you, Mr. Army General, neither of you will come to defend your legal president. And neither of them did. Both of them stood down because they were bribed and they were told that they'd have fair, free conduct after the coup. Of course, both of them were jailed. And they were taken to the Hague kangaroo court, as was Milosevic. And as soon as he was rendered to the illegal Hague court, the Hague court has no legitimacy under the Charter of the United Nations. This was the International Tribunal for the Former Yugoslavia, ICTY, International Criminal Tribunal for the Former Yugoslavia. So this tribunal had no legal basis whatsoever. Not only that, the constitution of Yugoslavia and of Serbia both interdict any extradition of Serbian citizens outside of the country. So the constitution was violated. A fake court, a kangaroo court, was created. And that kangaroo court served as a star chamber. And something like the Volk, I can't remember the name that the German Nazi Party set up at the end of its reign to try to quickly try and execute opponents of the Nazi regime. But a kind of a people's court was conducted inside the country, rounding up former supporters of President Milosevic, arresting them, putting them on without any charges in jail. The director of the national television station who survived the bombing was then rounded up and put away in prison for decades. There was a general purge here conducted of a list of people supplied by the U.S. Embassy. And I've said all of this publicly here in the country, and I have to say that I'm surprised to still be able to operate the way I have been. I guess that they think that there are enough people listening to me that they can't act against me. When Milosevic was taken to The Hague, he had his legal committee contact me. I then suggested that I should recruit the head of his defense committee. I recruited the man who had produced that website I mentioned earlier, TENC.net. His name is Jared Israel. He's a Jewish American, a 1960s student activist who stood up in order to defend President Milosevic. And I flew from Tokyo to recruit him at his home in Boston and fly him to Belgrade to bring him to President Milosevic, who was then being held in house arrest, and to let him personally decide whether he wanted to organize the defense for Milosevic, the financing, the coordination of legal teams, and so on. They met in private. I did not stay for the meeting. And Jared Israel accepted that job, and then others came forward and volunteered from countries around the world, including Canadians, Christopher C. Black, who worked at the Hague Tribunal, came as a lawyer from Toronto, and other lawyers from around the world. And then I met other activists like yourself in the media and in politics, who simply weren't going to take this all lying down. They defended Milosevic. All of us who contributed to his defense found each and every charge against him to be false. Not only did we find the charges to be false, we found the incontrovertible evidence that he was innocent. And that's why he was killed, because there was no unanimity among the judges hearing his case. And what that meant was that if it was allowed to go to a verdict, if Milosevic was allowed to be tried to the decision of that court, he was going to be acquitted. If he was acquitted, that means that the charges of him being a dictator and a ethnic cleanser and all of the other associated charges on which false charges, of course, all of those false charges on which NATO based its war of aggression against the former Yugoslavia would be thrown out, which would mean, by direct consequence, that the war on Yugoslavia itself was a war crime. He would have to be released. The coup that they staged to overthrow him would have to be undone by the court. Milosevic would have to be reinstated in freedom inside Serbia, where he would win any election he was allowed to run in. And a 20-year plan to destroy Yugoslavia and incorporate it into the Western NATO military-industrial complex would be set back. Obviously, when the other alternative is to poison the man in his cell by giving him medicines which are not recommended for his heart condition, in fact, the exact opposite medicines, including one which was used exclusively for the treatment of tuberculosis and which puts additional strain on the heart, were given to the president in addition to other things which I believe, I have no proof because we had no access to the jail cell, which were put into his food. Milosevic died with no one present to see him have a heart attack that they say he died of, with no autopsy properly done by the Hague Tribunal. But the problem was solved. There was no need to convict the man. He died an innocent man. But since he was dead, there was no final resolution proving that he was innocent or putting him back into power.
So I think actually it was Joseph Stalin that said, no person, no problem.
That's exactly right. And this I have to say, is somewhat reminiscent of the mysterious death of Napoleon Bonaparte on Ile Sainte Helena, where they say he was poisoned slowly by arsenic. This is how the permanent globalist empire deals with people who have the bravery to stand up and fight, even if they're outnumbered 19 countries to one, an infinite amount of weapons to a small self-defense force.
I seem to remember also a few years ago, one of the generals, the Yugoslav generals, actually poisoned himself on whilst he was being recorded, didn't he? And died.
Yeah, well, he poisoned himself. He was a Croatian general. He poisoned himself because he believed that his trial was unfair. He poisoned himself the minute they declared him guilty. In the end, the divided and conquered peoples of the former Yugoslavia largely realize that they were lied to, they were manipulated, they were conquered, and they were colonized. We now have an incredibly low standard of living after having a much higher standard of living than all of the countries in the region. We now have a total takeover of the economy by foreign enterprises, mainly from Germany and from America. We have 100% control of the media in the country by former CIA chief U.S. military officer Wesley Clark and his organization, who've taken over all of the mainstream media, the televisions, the radio stations, and the newspapers, including the newspaper of record. The equivalent of the New York Times of this country is now held by a NATO-backed consortium. So there's no way to get media out. Here in this country, I debated one of the first flunkies that the Americans appointed to represent Yugoslavia in Washington, a man who just so happened to be credible in the eyes of the public because his last name was the same as a former prime minister, Protich, which probably should ring a bell when we talk about Trudeau, who literally is only in power in Canada because the globalist organizers pulled him out of the woodwork and said, you've got the name Trudeau, we're going to make you the prime minister. You just do what we tell you and everything's going to be fine. And that's how they're grooming the Clinton's daughter. And that's how they groom new leaders in countries around the world.
Okay, well, you also mentioned Saif Gaddafi as well.
Yes, I'm going to bring directly about to him.
Very Saif interesting. Gaddafi. I mean, because obviously the whole attack on Libya was really, I mean, what they said was, oh, he's attacking his own people.
It's
David Cameron
lie.
Ordered
complete,
the Royal Navy to take over, etc. So anyway, can you tell us a little bit about who he was and and what involvement you have with him?
So Saif Gaddafi, like Milosevic, was a person who thought that a softening of the previous regime, Saif was softening his father's regime. I'm not saying softening in terms of stopping them from being war criminals or murdering people. I'm just talking about a slight easing of the system to achieve a compromise with the Western powers, which literally wanted to destroy their country. So Saif Gaddafi thought that, look, if I go to the London School of Economics and I study there and I meet people and I explain what we have in our country and how we're having an anti-imperial permanent revolution to undo the damage of Italian colonization and other colonization before that. And if I learn to speak English and express myself the way they express themselves, maybe I'll be able to get them to understand what we're doing. Well, that was unfortunately highly naive, and it was also naive on the part of Milosevic, because nobody cared what they said or what they intended to do, because they simply were not willing to be slaves on bended knee, neither of them. So Saif Gaddafi's efforts to find a common language with the West failed, and then the West basically, because of some investments in some bribes that were paid to France and Italy and some money moving around, the West felt that the best way to limit its losses in Libya would be to take over the country, kill all the Gaddafis if they could, seize the resources of the country, suck that money out, which was in the many billions of dollars, and recolonize the country and say that it was all done because Gaddafi was abusing some people and he was torturing some people and so on, of which we have no evidence. I have spoken with many people who met Muammar Gaddafi personally, working with him as engineers, project coordinators, political advisors, and so on. None of them confirm any of the wild accusations about a hardcore dictatorship. I spoke personally, and I was actually called by Saif Gaddafi after he was captured. He got himself to a mobile telephone, a sat phone, called London, and he had an office in London, which was, I presume, former embassy staff who had set up a broadcast center there for Libya 24, which was a television station operating just outside of the London area. And they relayed the link to me, and he called me personally and asked me, could I help him? Would I be willing to fly to London? At that time, I believe I was here in Belgrade. Would I be willing to fly to London and do interviews for Libya 24? And of course, I said yes. I went to London and recorded several hour long interviews showing the parallels between Serbia and Libya, and then offered to work on his defense case. But at that time, communications were cut. The British government intervened to close down Libya 24's operations, and I lost contact. I still had contact with his former Israeli girlfriend, with whom I still can communicate, but I'm just waiting for his case to come to some kind of public explanation, because the man is now free inside Libya and constitutes a legitimate political faction leader in the country who, if he's allowed to run in an election and has a fair chance, there's a very good possibility that he could roll back the colonial takeover of Libya, because the West just stole whatever it could in terms of gold and oil and gas from Libya, as much as it could and as much as it can pump right up until today. But they never were able to restore order there. And the public there has certainly seen through all of these scams and all of these activities. And just to put a back channel on all of this, when I left Tokyo and I traveled to Washington to work against the recognition of an independent pseudo state of Kosovo, after that mission failed, I stayed in Washington another 6 to 8 months working for the only independent intelligence agency in Washington. In other words, not working for the U.S. government and not working for either of their duopoly political parties. It's an Australian-led organization called the International Social Studies Association, ISSA, led by a man named Gregory Copley. Gregory Copley came to me and said, John, you seem to know quite a bit. I'd like you to join our operation so you don't have to leave Washington now that the Serbian Unity Congress, where I worked before, has turned out to be a CIA front organization. I mean, this is so intricate and so completely crazy, but there was a Serbian ethnic organization in America called the Serbian Unity Congress, which was created with the full coordination run by the CIA to create a fake Serbian lobby in America, which did nothing. Well, when I left Japan, I was extremely well paid over there in Japan. I was making maybe about $50,000 a month as a government expert and a consultant to all of these other companies. When I left Japan, I had to come somewhere else or go somewhere else to do something similar. Well, I went directly to Washington, was hired by the Serbian Unity Congress, thinking that there would be a Serbian lobby there. As soon as I got there, within a month of going to the public meetings and speaking literally the truth about what happened in the Balkans, the CIA sent a delegation to the organization, which was an NGO, and told them, either your NGO is going to be closed down or John Bosnich is not going to work here anymore. That was within 4 months of me starting work there. Okay. I was dismissed by the organization on CIA orders. And on my last day of work, in comes a leading representative of the Masons, the Masonic Order in Washington, who showed up at my office and said, "Hi, John, I'm so-and-so." I'm not going to reveal his name now. I'd like to have a chat with you. And I said, well, I'm really sorry, I can't, because I've got 24 hours under the NAFTA work employment rules that if I lose my job in the States as a NAFTA certified management consultant, I need to leave within 24 hours. So I have to pack my family. I've got two kids. I've got my wife, and I've literally got another 2 hours here in the office. And I'm unable to really deal with anything you might want to raise with this organization because I'm done with this organization. It's a fake front. It's a CIA front. And he goes, oh, you're worried about the deadline about getting out of the country? And I said, yes, of course I am. It's illegal to be in the country more than 24 hours after my contract is terminated. He goes, you know what, John? I wouldn't worry about that. And I said, what? He goes, I wouldn't worry too much about that. He said, come on down. Let's go for a drive around Washington. So here we are on my last day of work at 3:30 p.m. on a Friday, and we come downstairs, and there's an armored Cadillac black Escalade with tinted windows. He says, hop in. I hop in with him, and we've got two Outrider cars, one in front, one in back, and we drive around Washington, and he points out the sights. He points out the obelisk. He said, we brought that from Egypt. He points out the design of the buildings around Washington, and he points out these traditional Masonic symbol. And then he takes me to the Scottish Rite headquarters of the Masonic Lodge of Washington, of which he is the grand whatever it is. And he goes, come on in, have a look around. It's all open. Anything you want. We can bring you in here today. You can work here. You don't have any limits, and you can stay here. You can forget about needing a visa for America. What do you say, John? Name your salary. I said, what do you mean, name your salary? He said, name your salary. Be generous. And I said, unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to accept that because I gave my father my word I would never join a secret organization. He goes, I'm not angry. I thought this might be the case. Why is that that you took that advice from your father? And I said, well, my father was given the same offer by your organization roughly 50 years ago. My father's roommate at McGill University was Zbigniew Brzezinski, the man who wrote the book The Great Chessboard and who organized the toppling of the Shah of Iran and who brought Ayatollah Khomeini to power so that he could strike at the soft underbelly of the Soviet Union using jihadi Muslim fanatics. So my father at that time was offered the same deal that Zbigniew Brzezinski was offered, which he accepted. He went to Washington. My father turned it down. And my grandfather was offered the same deal by the Masonic Order between World War I and World War II, which he turned down. And shortly after he turned down that offer from the Masonic Order, the king of Yugoslavia was assassinated at Marseille. So we're talking about generations back. My family has been a political, military family since about the year 1200. And we have a lot of experience in how politics is done, how power is shared and stolen and sold, and how the average human being very, very seldom gets a picture of how the world is run that could let him or her choose a free life. I'm just very, very lucky to have been born into this family that has this past experience.
So your Masonic escort was gave up at that point, did he?
Yeah, he gave up at that point, but he's remained friendly. He said, when we make an offer, it's an offer for life. At any time that you choose to change your mind, you're welcome here at the Pinnacle. You might have to make 1 year of study to become a 33rd degree Grand Mason. And I'm not one of these believers in occult or conspiracy theories, because I'm a believer in conspiracies, not in conspiracy theories. I strongly believe that the 9/11 attacks were a coordinated effort. Either the CIA and the National Defense and Intelligence Services of the United States found out about an independent effort by the hijackers and let it happen and just, let's say, used the incident, or, which is probably more likely, they had an actual hand in it. Because I can tell you this, and I know this, I communicated with Big Brzezinski's office during the bombing of the former Yugoslavia. I contacted, he's passed away, unfortunately, but I contacted Big Brzezinski, not because I share his politics, he has the diametrically opposed politics, but because of the old roommate relationship between him and my late father. I contacted him in late May of 1999 during the NATO bombing, and I asked, just like that, like I'm speaking to you on this phone now, I asked in a voice call whether he could arrange a break in the bombing so that negotiations of a ceasefire and a truce could be had. 48 hours later, the bombing was suspended. I previously spoke to President Milosevic. I previously spoke to his foreign minister, Vladislav Jovanovic, the foreign minister of Yugoslavia, to arrange for him to meet with Big Brzezinski to see if they could put an end to the bombing. All of these offers were accepted. And I realized then that what we normal people, I mean, I grew up in a normal family in Canada, in a small town. I went to a normal high school. I did not go to some private, expensive upper class school. I did most of my learning at home from my father and from my mother, who is a union activist and a school teacher. And I can tell you that until it actually happens to you, until you actually somehow interface with the system at the peak, you don't believe that that's how things are done, that somebody can pick up a phone and end a war, that somebody can pick up a phone and build a pipeline, that somebody can pick up a phone and arrest the world chess champion with no grounds, or that Julian Assange can be arrested and held for years with no charge, on no charge. That's the reality. That's the reality of this world. And what we live in is not the reality. We live, the normal people of this world, until you get into this somehow, all of us live in the illusion. The reality is where the decisions are made. No decisions are made down here in the illusion in which we live.
We had a fascinating program put out by the BBC about the Douma chemical weapons attack in 2018. It was actually Peter Hitchens who put in a complaint to the BBC. And really the only reason the BBC looked seriously at his complaint is because they know he's got a column in the Mail on Sunday, and that if the BBC lies in their complaint or tries to drop it, then it'll be all over a national newspaper. And so they have to take his complaint seriously. And they found against the BBC, which is very, very rare that the BBC finds against itself. So
What
do you make of this, first of all, the attack itself, and secondly, the state of the Western media?
When you say the attack, you mean the chemical attack?
Well, the staged purported chemical attack, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, look, I spent literally years on the front line of battlefields across the Balkans. Years on end. And I can tell you that my access to battlefield information about Syria very, very, very clearly indicated that the Syrian government army, if allowed to fight one-to-one against the CIA-trained and CIA-recruited terrorists, would have wiped them out. There was no parity in weaponry or personnel or military capacity whatsoever. The only way in which these terrorists who were there, Al-Qaeda-inspired, ISIS, and so on, which are all just front names, they're all just fake names made up in Washington, they had no chance whatsoever against the Syrian army. The only way that they were able to be sustained was with U.S. support, with Israeli support, and with some support from Turkey along the border, where they were siphoning in weapons and munitions and literally providing close air support with the American-made F-16s. So since we know that the Syrian army has, first of all, it's a draft army from the people. It's not a professional army only like America's army. It's a drafted army where people serve in the national army of their country, like in Switzerland. So it's a democratic army. If the people of Syria are against their own so-called regime, the standard shibboleth of the lying mainstream media, the regime, then there would be no army in Syria. There would be no soldiers. But those soldiers, outgunned by the American air support and out-armed by the Turkish NATO feeding of weapons to professional terrorists. I mean, a lot of these guys weren't even Muslims. They pretended to be Muslims, pretended to conduct terror warfare as a Muslim front, but they were just mercenaries, professional soldiers who fight wherever they're sent. So the whole scenario there favored, if it was a fair fight, it favored the Syrian army. So simple logic tells us that it would make no sense whatsoever for the Syrian army to make a chemical weapons attack on its own citizens, even in a region that might have been somewhat rebellious. Maybe they weren't in favor of the Assad family staying in power. But it would make no sense whatsoever to use chemical weapons, which would bring a worldwide international outcry about war crimes against a president who very, very specifically instructed his army to fight by the laws of war. What possible gain could there be? First of all, President Assad has no reason to kill the children of his own country, because those were the people who were shown on television. President Assad had no reason whatsoever to use chemical weapons, which would not wipe out an enemy fighting force, but would kill civilians only for no benefit whatsoever to himself or his side in the war. And finally, if he were insane, which he's obviously not, anybody who's followed his speeches, his discussions, his interviews knows that the man is not insane. If he were insane, even an insane man would not order such an attack in such an obvious way as to point directly at himself as if he had ordered it. So, all logic tells us that the event was staged, that it was visibly staged in daylight so that cameras could be used to produce the horror story of an image that was presented to the world. And we also have the CIA penetrated World Organization for Monitoring Chemical Weapons on the spot at the time. So this is, you couldn't make a recipe for a better propaganda story if you scripted it all years in advance, which they probably did, because we know, and this is not denied by anyone, that the United States was routinely providing chemical weapons to their CIA agent and trainee, Saddam Hussein, in Iraq to use against Iran when Saddam Hussein was their client dictator in Iraq. And the weapons that were used against Iran were chemical weapons provided by, of course, the CIA. So all roads lead to Rome. And Rome, the new Rome of this world, is Washington, D.C., with a few advisors on the line from London trying to civilize them so that they don't look like brute force murderers, but in fact, like the world's policemen, which is perhaps the biggest joke of all.
So this whole agenda of which the attempted overthrow of Assad, which now looks due to the Russian presence in the region to have really hit a brick wall, what's the wider agenda? Where do you think that this competition between Russia, China and the West, where is it heading?
Well, it's not a competition between Russia and China and the West, because Russia and China have no interest in military competition with anyone. It is a defensive stance by those remaining independent countries of the world, which includes China, Russia, India, and the rest of the BRICS countries, and the smaller countries which are not up to the level of being in the BRICS alliance, trying to maintain their state sovereignty. The reason why the Western powers are opposed to state sovereignty is because state sovereignty provides a basis for domestic law in those countries, where those countries can pass laws that ensure that their resources are retained for the best interests of their population. What we're looking at here is a projection of the old style Britannia rules the waves worldwide empire of piracy. It's not a joke to say that many of the British fleet ships operated in daytime under the Union Jack, or whatever the flag was at that time earlier, before it became the Union Jack, but it was a crossed design, which was simply swapped for a skull and crossbones of the pirate fleets that operated in the same boats with the same men, looting the riches of the New World, looting the Spanish galleons, looting the Portuguese ships, looting the French fur traders. So basically what we've got is an extension of the English former worldwide empire on which the sun would never set. The racist empire that they created in India, in South Africa, wherever you could find a black nation, England was there to enslave them. That empire after World War II was too weak to continue on its own, so it amalgamated with the new brute force of the American industrial power base and created the Anglo-American Empire. The Anglo-American Empire is largely inspired from London and from the educational institutions of the old racist Anglo world order, which then trains, as we mentioned before, the leading lights of the American money order. And the two of them work very well together because one is full of the resources of the stolen continent of North America, and the other one is full of the experience of having stolen the resources of the world for centuries. They make a perfect combo, and what they are the aggressor states. And they try first to buy you, to co-opt you, to make you one of their friends, as they tried to do with Gandhi. Give the man a Rhodes Scholarship. Bring him to London. Let's train the man. Everything's going to be fine. This is how they start. They train the bright young lights of the former colonies and the Commonwealth and American dependencies. They bring them to good schools and they try to co-opt them. When co-option doesn't work, they bribe them. When bribing them doesn't work, they extort them. When extortion doesn't work, they attack, invade, and kill them. And that's the formula. And it's not something too secret. It's been used around the planet.
Well, look, a lot of the focus is still on the Middle East. I'm sure you'll acknowledge. I'm sure you'll acknowledge that Israel plays quite a big part in this Anglo-American
empire. The Israel lobby, and that's a good book in itself. There's a book called The Israel Lobby, written by a friend of mine named John Mearsheimer, who's based in Washington. He's an analyst and a political scientist who analyzed the power of the Israel lobby, not the Jewish lobby. It's the Israel lobby. There are many Jews in America who are opposed to the Israel lobby and who are opposed to the Anglo-American Empire. It's the Israel state lobby. The Israel state lobby organizes through the Jews in America who support the Israel lobby. That's not all the Jews. That's some of the Jews in America. And this is not a racist comment. It has nothing to do with race or religion. It has to do with the lobby and the people who it enriches and who enrich it. Mearsheimer pointed out in his book that 40%, well, let's start the other way. 60% of the donations to the Democratic Party of America come from Jewish Americans. That may be money from their own work and life, or it could be money being filtered from Israel through them as contributors to the party of the Democratic Party. Okay, that's pretty well known, but he did a statistical and certified analysis of those figures. But the more interesting factor is that 40% of the money that finances the operations of the Republican Party also comes from the Israel lobby, which means you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. The same lobby controls both parties. It's the single biggest financial coordinator of the operation of political parties in America, where only the rich can win. It's not a surprise that a billionaire named Donald Trump came to power in America, because you need to be a billionaire or you need to have billions behind you to become the president. Once in a while, they pull the wool over our eyes by creating a fake candidate like Barack Obama, who I call Barrage Obama, who just so happened to be the perfect fake puppet candidate for the military-industrial complex to train, groom, indoctrinate, and teleprompt into the White House when the United States realized that the real battlefield on the world today is Africa, resource-rich Africa. So what better way to take over the continent of Africa than to elect a man who looks black, but who's actually what is called in America an Oreo, named after the Oreo cookie, which is white on the inside and black chocolate on the outside, two halves. Barack Obama was the perfect Oreo. He walked white, he talked white, and more importantly than anything else, he bombed white. And a lot of my left-leaning, uninformed friends in America and Canada thought, oh, it's great. We got a black guy finally as the president. But that's a facade. And when they finally get a female president, when Biden steps aside to put Kamala Harris in the presidency, they're not getting a female president. Being a female has nothing to do with her function there, except to deceive the public. And Hillary was supposed to be, I call her Hitlery Kiloton, because she likes bombing just as much as Barack Obama did. But these are all facades. It's like walking through a house of mirrors in which your desires are reflected back to you in the form of a fake candidate from a fake party, from a fake system.
How do listeners follow your work? Where's the best place to find you?
Well, I've been doing a lot, since I learned Serbian, I've been doing a lot of work here because I kind of think that fighting on the home front, even though I wasn't born here and didn't grow up here, but fighting on the home front is usually more effective. So those very, very few who can understand Serbian can watch me on YouTube. You'll just put my name in, Johnbosnitch, for things that I've done in English. I'm on, I think, about 50 or 60 videos where I worked without pay, voluntarily, for Russia Today on all manner of subjects. So if you look up RT John Bosnich, Johnbosnitch, you can review, I think, some 40 or 50 YouTube-saved videos that I've done there. You can also look me up if you happen to speak Serbian. You can look me up under the name DZON. That's how they say John. That's how they write John in Latin characters here in Serbia. So DZON space BOSNIC, because the original spelling of my name is with ch, with a little c with an accent aigu, an accent to the right. So BOSNIC. There you'll see a large number of long debates, up to 5 hours in length, against various political factions here who are all working for NATO and all taking orders from London, Berlin, Paris, or Washington. Without exception, unfortunately. I've also done some things in French. They're probably a bit harder to find. And I even did a few comments in limited Japanese. I did learn a few words of Japanese over there. However, if you just put my name in the search box in Google or wherever, you'll come up to the Wikipedia entry that some people have wrote about me. You might find some IMDb from some films I've appeared in. Oh, I know where you should look. Here's something that is perhaps the best educational resource for anybody who wants to know what happened in the former Yugoslavia. Look up a movie. It's on YouTube. It's free. It's about 2 hours long, I think, unfortunately, called The Weight of Chains. Okay, it's called The Weight of Chains. It's a film made by a young Canadian Serb, born in Serbia, went to Canada as a young man, was doing a cinema studies degree at University of British Columbia, opted to make a film about the collapse and destruction of the former Yugoslavia. The fully propagandized and indoctrinated professors refused to let him do his university degree program, master's, I think he was doing a master's degree, thesis in the form of a film, even though he was doing cinema studies. He said, if you're not going to let me do the film I want to make, I'm dropping out. He dropped out. He showed up where I remember I told you I was working in Washington as a Serbian spokesman there. This 22-year-old kid at that time named Boris Malagurski, B-O-R-I-S, Boris Malagurski, M-A-L-A-G-U-R-S-K-I. This guy shows up at age 22 and asks for $20 donation so that he can pay for the bus to go from Washington to New York to, just by chance, interview a friend of mine who is the director of an organization called JRI, the Jasenovac Research Institute. What is Jasenovac? Jasenovac was the World War II Auschwitz of the Balkans. So he asked for a $20 donation so he could pay a bus to go to New York to meet my friend. I said, well, I'm not going to give you 20 bucks. I'm going to drive you there. And so we drove that four-hour drive from Washington, or 5 hours, whatever it was. We drove that drive together. And he just asked me questions all the way up and all the way back. And after 10 hours in a car with me, I mean, you've had to deal with this long interview with me, but can you imagine 10 hours of that? At the end of 10 hours of that, he produced the film based on our discussions and on follow-up interviews with all the people I suggested or proposed that he might want to meet, in addition to his own extensive research. Anybody who watches that film, The Weight of Chains, available on YouTube for free. And the film is bilingual, Serbian and English. So when the person being interviewed speaks Serbian or Bosnian or whatever you want to call it, it's all the same language, Croatian. Whenever the person being interviewed speaks the local language, there are subtitles in English. Whenever the person being interviewed, like General Lewis McKenzie, the first head of the United Nations Protection Force in Bosnia, when he's being interviewed in English, then the subtitles are in Serbian. So that is the Cole's notes in 2 hours flat of what happened to Yugoslavia. And it's a work of genius. And Boris Malagurski, that 22-year-old kid, turned out to be one of the most effective activists here in the former Yugoslavia. And he's still active today with his own TV programs and more movies since then. So there are several versions of The Weight of Chains. The first one is the one you need to see. It's called The Weight of Chains 1, or The Weight of Chains. There's The Weight of Chains 2 and 3 and so on, but it becomes more complex. Watch that first movie, and you will suddenly know more about what happened in the Balkans than every purported lying mainstream media expert, quote unquote, that you'll ever meet.
John Bosnich, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.